Dick Allegro. I'm an alcoholic. I have to excuse. I'm a little nervous. You know, Tom told me to come a little early tonight because he had to wire me. And he said I had to stand right here and I shouldn't worry about the water. Then he hands me a metal stand. You know where I got this? You know why he's wearing this vest? I cut this tie out of the back of his shirt. You know, when they told me or asked me to speak tonight, I got really nervous because for all the times I've been coming up here to the assembly, I knew on Saturday night they always had great speakers. So I knew I had to have just a top-notch talk to give tonight. So ever since they asked me, I've been practicing every day. I want you to know I had a terrific story ready to give you tonight. Then my wife decided to come. So I'm going to have to tell you the truth instead. She told me when it was time for me to speak, I should tell what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And I used to stand up here and say that I drank too much too often for too long till I crossed the line between social and problem and alcoholic drinking. The longer I'm sober and the more I look back, the more I realize there was never a period of social drinking in my life. I don't remember my first drink or my first drunk. They evidently happened on the same night, and it's been related to me many times. I was whatever age you are when you're a toddler running around. My aunt and uncle were over sharing a bottle of wine with my parents, and I would go out into the kitchen and climb on my mother's lap and get a sample. Then I'd go down to the front room and get a taste from my uncle, and then I would go back. And later on in the evening, they heard this thumping sound in the hallway. And when they went to investigate, here was this little kid bouncing off the walls, trying to get to one more drink. And that's my whole story. The places change, the people change, the drinks change, the results never change. It didn't matter from that time to the time I got to these rooms, whenever I started to drink, I went until I couldn't go any further. It was a while after that before I was able to get a hold of any alcohol. But by the time I was in high school, I had figured out that if I drank, I fit in. If I drank, I could be anybody. If I drank, I could go anywhere. And if I didn't drink, I didn't fit in. If I didn't drink, I couldn't go anywhere or do anything. So while my classmates were out there maturing and making the mistakes and learning from them, I was solving all my problems with alcohol. So by the time I got to these rooms many years later, my emotional level was still back. Some people say it still is, but still back at that level. The day I got out of high school, my father took me to the front gates of the steel mills, and he said, you have two choices. You can spend the rest of your life in here at hard physical labor, or you can find a way to get yourself down to college and get a ticket out of here. And it didn't take me more than 2 hours inside those mills to figure out that working was not going to be my strong suit. So I found a way to get down to campus and a college education, and I would like to share with you tonight some of those wonderful times I had as a collegian, but the truth is I don't remember. I didn't know what a blackout was till I got to these rooms, but I've been experiencing them since high school, and I don't remember very much about it. Once I got down to campus and the restraints were removed, the drinking progressed. My standard pattern would be get up in the morning, find the largest bottle of whatever alcoholic beverage I could get a hold of, and I would start the quote-unquote party. And I would drink for 12 or 18 or 24 hours until I passed out. And they'd pick me up and throw me into bed, and I'd sleep for 12, 14 hours, and I would get up and I would start again. And I thought I was having a wonderful time. But when you do that, I had this whole problem. I kept flunking out a lot. So it took me 6 years to get out of there. But at the beginning of my second senior year, I thought I met the answer to my problem, so I married her. I thought she had money. Then I had a problem. You know, I had a wife. I needed to graduate and go get a job. And I decided that if I was going to have to go to work, I needed the type of job that would support me in the style to which I thought I should become accustomed. So I decided that I would become a corporate executive. So I went out and got myself a gray flannel suit, flat top, a briefcase, and I got myself a job as a trainee with a Fortune 100 company in downtown Chicago, and I went out to make my fortune. One of the requirements of the job that I was in was that I had to go to school two nights a week, to graduate school, to get a master's degree. And the way they worked that is they let us out around 5 o'clock. We had an hour and a half to get something to eat and down and ready for class. And the first night of class, I just happened to run into some people, the story of my life. I just ran into some people who, instead of going to dinner that night, were going to go have a drink to celebrate the start of the new school year. So we went across the street to this little cocktail lounge on Michigan Avenue, and I discovered the nectar of the gods. It's called a martini. And I fell in love with him. For the next 3 years, two nights a week, where everybody was having dinner and getting down to class, I was having 5 or 6 martinis preparing for class. And interestingly enough, I always made it to class. I did not always make it to the right class. So surprisingly, I did very well, you know, as long as I remembered to drink the night of the exam. You know, that's the way I heard all the lectures. And on the job, I did very well, and I became the fair-haired boy, and they started to groom me to go up the corporate ladder. And they made me an expert in planning. And I took those planning skills, and I applied them to my personal life, and I developed 6-month plans, 1 year, 3 year, 5 year plans. And if you asked me what the purpose of those plans were, I would tell you that it was to get the next promotion, to get a raise, to get a bigger house, or a newer car. But inside, I knew that I was frightened, and I was scared, and I didn't know what was going on, and I was miserable, and I believed if I got the next job, or the promotion, or the raise, or a bigger house, I would find some peace, and I would find some happiness. And I always beat the plan, I always got the promotion, I always got the bigger house, I never found any peace, never found any happiness. So a month into a new job, I would have to start planning for the next job, because that promotion was the one that was finally going to make me happy. Then I discovered the secret to success in corporate America. What you do is you drink with your boss's boss. Then what happens one day, they call you down to the corporate headquarters and they have this huge walk-in vault and it has magnetized blackboards around the sides and people's names on magnetic strips. And they pull back the curtain and they say, here is the new organization chart for this division and my boss would be working for me. And there's a couple problems with getting ahead that way. One is I started to worry a lot about who the people working for me were drinking with. Because I figured everybody was doing the same thing I was. The other thing was I was always afraid that I hadn't earned the job that I was moving into and that I wasn't capable of handling it. And if I stayed in it very long, they were going to figure that out. So I had to get promoted again before they found out. And that worked great till I was about 30 years old. And there were only 2 jobs above me in the company. And both of them were better at playing the game than I was. And I wasn't going to go anywhere for 10 years. So I did the only logical thing. I resigned. And I went out and I became a consultant. And I want to tell you, for an active alcoholic, a consultant is a terrific job. They pay you to drink with people. You know, you take people to martini lunches. You take them to dinners with brandy. You know, and it's just wonderful. Except I didn't find any peace and I didn't find any happiness there either. So I made a geographic and career change and I moved from Chicago to Indianapolis and I opened up my own practice. Because then I wasn't going to have all these pressures, I wouldn't have all these people on my back, I'd be rewarded for all of my own efforts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the only problem was I took me with me. And I got down there and I opened up the business and I worked very hard. I was in the office early in the morning, I stayed there till late at night. The practice began to grow. When I wasn't working, I was drinking, and that was my life. I worked, I drank, and I slept. Carolyn says, I worked, I drank, and I passed out. That's just the manners. And that was my life. You know, in the practice group, the blackouts began to get worse. It was always exciting when my American Express bill came in. They were always charging me for airline tickets to towns I'd never been to. So. And charging me for restaurants I'd never heard of, and I was always going to sue them, but I never got around to it. I began to lose my tolerance. I never knew when I sat down on the bar stool whether I was going to have one drink and fall off, or whether I was going to sit there drinking all night, and it wouldn't hardly faze me. I preferred to drink at home. The service was faster, the drinks were bigger, and in the morning I didn't have to worry where my car was, or where I was. And that was basically my life. You know, none of the terrible things happened to me. I didn't run into any school buses. You know, I didn't have any tragic. I didn't burn down any buildings. I was just out there sick and tired. I was so sick and so miserable for so long, I thought I was normal. I didn't know there was anything wrong with the way I was living. Then I remember it was on April 13th. It was a Saturday. It was the end of tax season. We had just finished everything up. I remember driving home. I remember mixing the first martini to start the party. And the next thing I remember, it was like 2 o'clock in the morning, the Monday, April 15th. And I was sitting in my favorite drinking chair, and it was one of those times when I was just drinking and nothing was happening. And I started to take a look at my life and how screwed up everything was. And I knew that I couldn't keep going the way I was going and that I needed to make a change. So I started to lay out a couple of plans of what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And after a couple of those, I realized that everything I planned to do always ended up getting me in a position where I could drink. And I realized that all I wanted to do with the rest of my life was to drink, and it was probably going to kill me, and that was okay. At that point in my life, that was just okay. But I still had this wife, and I knew that I couldn't sit there and drink 24 hours a day, at least not peacefully. So I had to make a plan on how I could get myself out of there and into a position where I could drink. And like I said, it was the end of season. I hadn't been paying attention to paying bills or my taxes or things like that. And there was a fair amount of money in this checking account. So I decided what I would do is I would go down and draw it all out in cash. And I would go out to the airport, and with this American Express card that was always billing me for airlines I never used, I would buy an airline ticket under my name to New York. And I would go in through the checkout procedure, then I would slip out the side, and I would go down to another airline, and for cash under another name, I would buy a ticket to Los Angeles. Now, who at this point in my life I thought would bother looking for me? I don't know. But I had to have this really great plan on how I was going to get out of there. And I want you to know I'm a responsible guy, and I knew I was leaving behind a wife and child, so I was going to leave $500 in the checking account. I'm not very proud of that, but that was the plan. And when I got to Los Angeles, I was going to get myself a room above a liquor store that was open 24 hours and delivered. And I was going to sit up there and drink, and hopefully I would die before I ran out of money. And I fell asleep, took a little nap. I woke up in the morning, and for some reason I decided to keep an appointment in downtown Indianapolis. And I drove down there, and the client didn't show up. And I was driving back to my office. I was going up Meridian Avenue, the main north-south road through Indianapolis. And the next thing I knew, my car was up on the sidewalk, the front bumper against the phone booth, and I was talking to the intergroup office of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know today how that could happen. But at that time, I had no idea why I would call AA, where I got the number, or what I was doing then. And this delightful lady was telling me how nice it is on the other side of the bottle. And she was concerned, and she wanted to know whether or not she needed to get someone there through the phone booth before she hung up, or whether I could wait till that night without taking a drink, and she'd have somebody come to the house. And I got just a little upset, just because I drove my car up on the sidewalk at 8 o'clock in the morning and called Alcoholics Anonymous does not mean I have a problem. So finally, I gave her my name and address and phone number and convinced her I could make it to that evening. And I left, and then I had a problem. I had to go home and explain to my wife that I'd called Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of those people was going to be coming to our home. I was sure she was going to tell me there was no way that I could be an alcoholic and I should call him and cancel. That was not her reaction. Anyway, that night, this elderly gentleman came to the house, you know, smiling from ear to ear. You know how they do when they think they've got you, you know. And I don't know what I was expecting, but it certainly wasn't Roy. And he came in, and he shared with me some of his story and what alcohol had done to him and how AA was working in his life. And he gave me this little pamphlet that they were using in Indianapolis at that time of 40 questions. And he said, now, don't worry about your answers. You don't have to tell them to anyone. Just go over there in the corner and sit in there and be as honest as you can. And I thought, I got him. I am an expert at taking tests. There's 40 questions here. I can miss 7 or 8. That would give me 80. That's got to be passing. They'll tell me I'm not an alcoholic. You know? So I sat down there and I took this little quiz, giving myself the benefit of the doubt. And I got to the end and it says, if you answer yes to one of these questions, you need to take a look at your drinking. If you answered yes to two, you may have a problem. If you answered yes to three, there's no doubt about it. And I told Roy the test was rigged. That nobody could pass that test, and that's how Alcoholics Anonymous built its membership. Roy just smiled and said, it's going to be all right. And he asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting. Well, I didn't want to go to any meeting, but I was pretty well boxed in at that time, so I agreed. And we went to this meeting. It was a speaker's meeting. There were about 80 people there, all of them smiling. You know, my life's falling apart. I end up at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and these people are all delighted to see me, you know. So I knew when I walked in the room that there was something there. It took me months to figure out what it was, but it was peace and love and serenity, and I hadn't known any of those for so long I didn't recognize them. And the man got up that night and he told my story. Just absolutely told my story. I don't want you to think I have an ego problem or anything, but I was so sure they wanted me to join AA that what they did was call my wife, get my whole story, so this guy would stand up there and tell it. I'd think I was alcoholic, I'd join, and they could put my name on their letterhead. Member of the board. After the meeting, this guy came up to me and he said, if you wanted a drink tonight, do you have enough money to buy a fifth of whiskey? I assured him that I did. He said, good, you have enough money to buy a big book. So he took me up to the literature table. Well, he took me up to the literature table and took my money, so he did. But he gave me this book and he explained to me that it was written by the first 100 men and women who found a way to stay sober with this program, and that if I was looking for sobriety, he would suggest that I study that book and do what they did. And then they sat me down and they told me that it was suggested that I go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And I explained to them that I was just far too busy to do that. And they just smiled and said, it'd be all right. And they started to give me the slogans, you know, easy does it, let go, let God. And I said, look, no, that's fine for these guys that have been coming in here with wet brains. You know, they've been drinking all this time. But I'm an educated guy, and what you should do is give me the theory behind how Alcoholics Anonymous works, and I'll take your big book and some of these pamphlets, and I'll go home, and when I get this figured out, I'll get back with you. They all just smile and say, oh, just keep coming back. And Roy told me he'd be my temporary sponsor for 30 days. And he'd take me around to meetings, he'd introduce me to people, he'd show me the ropes. And he'd be available 24 hours a day should I need him. And that during those 30 days, I should find a person who had the type of sobriety that I would like to have. And at the end of the 30 days, I was to ask them to be my sponsor. It was really very simple. At the end of the 30 days, I asked Roy to be my sponsor, because from that day to this, I've never met a man with the serenity that he had. There was one problem, just one problem. With Roy, he drank for a long time, and he had this speech problem. He could not talk in complete sentences. All he could say was little short phrases. Don't drink. Go to meetings. Reminded me of one of those little dolls with the pool string. You know, it didn't matter what you said to him. You know, my life's falling apart. Don't drink. I'm happy to report that later on he did get to the point where he could carry on a regular conversation. And I didn't know at that point whether I was alcoholic or not, and if I was alcoholic, whether I wanted to do anything about it. But I knew that I was a mess and that I had to do something, so I thought I would give this program a try. And I entered what I call my first phase of recovery. And looking back over my sobriety, there has been many different phases. And some phases for me will last 2 or 3 weeks, and some will last 4 to 5 months. Occasionally, I'm in more than one phase at the same time, and some phases are recurring. But my first phase was what I call the bewilderment phase, otherwise known as what's a nice guy like me doing at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. But I couldn't figure out why I was here. You know, my definition of an alcoholic was some old guy, and I was younger then, you know. Who drank cheap wine out of paper bags and slept under viaducts. Mm-hmm. And I always drank expensive wine, and I never slept under a viaduct unless I was in a big car. And somehow, in my mind, there was a difference. But after I sat around these meetings for a while, it became obvious I was in the right place. My next phase is what I call the walking on eggshells phase. This covered the period of time between when I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and Carolyn went to Al-Anon to get help for herself. And they all walked around the house, don't do anything to make him drink. I love this phase. If I didn't want to do something, I had to say, oh, if I have to do that, that's going to make me so nervous and so upset, I might drink. She said, well, don't drink or don't do it. And I'd say, okay. Then she started going to Al-Anon to get help for herself. And her answer became, you'll drink if you want to drink. And that's your problem. And that was the end of that phase. My next phase was the why did I drink phase. I was sure there had to be some chemical deficiency in my body or some traumatic experience that happened to me when I was a child that caused me to drink this way. And they finally sat me down and said, look, the only reason you want to know why you drank is so you can fix it and go drink again. True. And they explained to me that alcoholism was a disease, and once I had crossed the line, there was no known cure. However, the illness could be arrested, and if I would put nearly as much effort into working this program, I would find myself a life I never dreamed imaginable. Then I went into my trophy phase. I was sure there had to be an annual banquet of Alcoholics Anonymous at which they would give out a trophy for Rookie of the Year. And I figured that probably went to the person who got through the 12 steps in the shortest period of time. And I was going to win it. You know? So I made out a plan. I would be through the first step at 9 in the morning, and I'd be through the second step at 11. And I laid it out like that. And I want to tell you, if you only work those part of the steps that apply to you, there really isn't anything to this. So I was able to admit that I was powerless over alcohol. But my life certainly wasn't unmanageable, and that took care of the first step. And everything worked great till around midnight one night when I was through the first 11 steps. I was on the 12th step, and it was time for my spiritual awakening. And I had converted my drinking chair into a meditation chair, and I had a thermos of coffee, a big book of 12 and 12, a stack of pamphlets, and a Bible. And I sat down to have my spiritual awakening. I sat there all night. I tried it with the lights on and the lights off. I tried it standing up, sitting down, and kneeling down. And nothing happened. In the morning, I called my sponsor and said, this program don't work. Said I was through the first 11 steps. That was certainly news to him. But so I was on the 12th step. It was time for my spiritual awakening. I sat up all night. Nothing happened. He said, don't drink. My next phase was one of my many pity pot phases. I hadn't drank for a couple months, and I was dry, not sober, but I was dry. And things weren't getting a whole lot better, and I went to that same speaker meeting, only that night they were trying to recruit somebody else. And the guy gave a different story, and I sat there and said, well, if that guy's an alcoholic, I'm not, and I can probably drink. And I could have said anything to any one of those 80 people, and they would have stayed with me as long as necessary to help me get past that moment. But I didn't. As soon as the Lord's Prayer was over, I was out the door, and I was down at one of my favorite watering holes. And I don't remember the drink I ordered. It was something I didn't normally drink, and I ordered this thing, and I drank about half of it. And then I went home, and I went to bed, and I got up in the morning, and I said, aha, I'm not an alcoholic. I had one drink, stopped. I didn't even drink all of that. I don't feel guilty. AA didn't ruin my drinking. I must not be an alcoholic. And I started to plan my next drink. My next drink was going to take a little planning because I needed a motel, I needed a couple cases of booze, and I needed several hundred dollars. And while I was trying to get that together, on a Sunday morning, Roy called and said, get up. We're going to a breakfast meeting. And he knew I was in trouble. I didn't tell him. I only told him what I thought he wanted to hear. but he knew that I was in trouble. And he came by, and we went to that breakfast meeting, and afterwards he spent most of that day with me, and I finally opened up and told him what was going on. And that night I went to a discussion meeting, and for the first time was honest. And by this time I had been dry long enough that I knew that I was alcoholic. I knew that if I didn't get sober and started drinking again, that I could die an alcoholic death, and I no longer wanted to die. And they spent that meeting sharing their experience, strength, and hope with me about this program. And I left there for the first time with hope that this program could work for me. And then I went into a let's work the steps with the guidance of the sponsor phase. And I would like to tell you from that point forward, whatever Roy told me to do, I truthfully went and did. Except you know I wasn't telling the truth. But I had become teachable. I had become willing to try. And when Roy said, when I had that kind of problem, my sponsor told me to do this, and I did, and it worked, why don't you try that? I became willing to try that. And I found out I wasn't quite so unique. And things started to get better, and I was going along. And they had told me not to do anything, make any major changes in my life for the first year. But I figured I was doing everything twice as fast. So after about 6 months, without guidance of my sponsor, I decided I couldn't stay sober and keep this practice, so I sold it. Then I went into one of my many what am I going to be phases, you know. I was perfectly willing to believe that God got you all sober so that you could lead normal, productive lives. But that ego I don't have kept telling me that God got me sober for some great purpose that has not yet been revealed. So while I was looking for that, and at the same time I was in a save them all phase, and I had decided that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was just far too valuable to restrict to alcoholics, and just think how wonderful a world this would be if everybody practiced these principles in all their affairs. So then it came to me that the great purpose God got me sober for was probably to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to the world at large, and he and he probably wanted me to do that as a minister. You follow the thinking. I quit trying. And there was a seminary in Indianapolis at that time that took some interdenominational students. So I went to them and I told them my story and what alcohol had done in my life and what AA was doing, and that I thought God got me sober so that I could carry this message to the world through the pulpit. And I want you to know... They were sicker than I was. They thought it was a great idea. And they just pulled out these forms, and we started filling them out. You know, I was enrolling. And everything worked great till we got to the question, what denomination are you going to be ordained? I said, what? They said, what denomination are you going to be ordained? And I said, oh, we have to answer that now. You know, I haven't been to church in 15 years. And when I did go, I was a Catholic, and I knew they weren't going to let me be a priest with a wife and kid. You know? They said, no, that's a third-year question. You know? All courses are the same the first 2 years. You don't have to decide that till the third year. And I thought, maybe I ought to go get a job in a field in which I'm trained and go to church for a while and see what a minister does first. You know. So I sent out some resumes, and within a week I had a job, right? And that was great, except the job was over in central Illinois, and Roy wouldn't move. So I had to go over there without my sponsor. So, and he told me the first thing I did when I got there, I needed to go to a meeting. So I went to one of their meetings, right? And they didn't have the slightest idea how the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was supposed to work. You know, they just didn't. And, you know, I would stand up in their meetings and tell them it was just a miracle. That any of them were sober as little as they knew about the program. And they'd just smile as they keep coming back. You know? God had really sent them one this time. And I would drive 3 hours one way back to Indianapolis to go to real AA meetings. You know? And they let me do that for a while. I think twice. You've moved over there. You have to go to meetings over there. You've been taught what you need to do for you to stay sober and how you need to work this program. Now you go back over there and you quit worrying about what everybody else is doing and you work your program for you the way you were taught. And so that's what I did. And you'd be surprised how much better those people were doing. Then I went into another save them all phase, only this time I restricted myself to alcoholics. Unfortunately, not alcoholics who expressed a desire to quit drinking. I chased them around. I hauled them. I drove around their house at night, you know. And they finally explained to me that what I was supposed to do was just carry the message, and it wasn't my responsibility to see that they didn't drink. I needed to be a channel for my higher power to communicate through, and then it was up to them and their higher power as to whether or not they got sober, and that I wasn't going to get any trophy if they stayed sober, and it wasn't my fault if they drank. Then we went into a growing together phase, and I was going to my meetings, working my program to the best of my ability for myself, and Carolyn was going to her Al-Anon meetings, working her program as best as she could for herself. Then we would come home and we'd sit up to all hours talking about the topics and sharing them, and we began to grow. And I would grow and spurt ahead, and then she'd catch up, pass me, and then of course I'd have to work twice as hard because we couldn't have that. And over the years, we just grew together. Until today, she is not only my wife, but she is my best friend. And I thank God every day for the program of Al-Anon. Because I cannot imagine life today, drunk or sober, without him. Then we were there for about 4 hours. I call this my wilderness phase, or our wilderness phase. And I was sure God sent us over there to learn something. And I had learned it, and if she would, we could leave. Things started to go fairly well there, and but in about 4 years, it was clear that at the company that I was with that I needed to make a change. And only this time I sat down and I discussed this with my sponsor, and we decided that my motivation was right and the timing was right, and it made sense for me to make a change. The problem was I was now about 40 years old, and I couldn't just keep making these changes, and I knew God was busy and he might not realize how important this particular move was, so I thought I needed to give him a little help. So I made up a list of questions for him to answer, about 30 of them. And I needed to know that house I was in was going to sell and sell relatively quickly. I needed to know that it would sell for a certain price because I needed the money. I needed to know where I was supposed to move because I didn't want to go through another one of those where they didn't know how AA work things, and I needed to know that I was going to be a success, because certainly I couldn't move somewhere and fail. And I put myself through 2 months of agony. It was just terrible. And I was driving over to Indianapolis one morning for a board meeting, and I realized that if in fact there was a higher power and I believed in this higher power, and I had turned my life and my will over to this higher power, then I didn't need to know the answer to the 30th question before I took the first step. Because if my motivation was right, the outcome might not be what I wanted, but I would be okay. So when I got to Indianapolis that morning, I went in and resigned. What was the first thing on the list? Then I called Carolyn, told her she needed to do something about that house because I didn't have a job. And I stayed in meetings in Indianapolis that day, and I got home about 6:30 that night. House was sold. Paid asking price. Cash buyer, close anytime you want. And I said, okay, God, that's a pretty good start. Well, I said, now you better tell me where I'm supposed to move, because I don't have a house and I don't have a job. And about 3 days later, there was a realtor there who put little plastic bags on doorknobs, and inside were pamphlets, 6 to 8 pages of pictures of home. And the neighbors on both sides and across the street and all the people we knew in the program got brochures of homes for sale in Bloomington, Illinois, and we got a brochure of homes for sale in Orlando, Florida. And I picked up the phone and called the broker and told him what happened. And he said, well, I don't know what to tell you. We're a member of this association, and we get all of our printing done at the same place in St. Louis, and I don't know how it could happen, but one of their brochures got mixed in with ours and ended up on your door. And I said, never mind, I know how it happened. Now, that's kind of an extreme example. But when I am working my program on a daily basis, and turning my life and my will over to my higher power, as I understand it, things like that happen in my life all the time. And Carolyn got on an airplane, and she came down to Orlando, and she bought a house. And we moved down here, and I went to the meeting first day. I walked into the meeting, first person I met, I said, "Hi, I'm Dick Gallery, I just moved here from Illinois." This guy kind of stepped back and looked at me. He said, "We don't care how they do it in Illinois." I said, "That's okay with me. I've been through that. You know, any way you guys want to do this, that's fine, you know." And they do it great in Central Florida. And by this time, you know, with all that had happened, I was totally convinced that God was sending me down here and I was going to be the biggest success that, you know, that there's just ever been. And I rented this office. I bought a desk, chair, and adding machine, put in a phone, sat down, waited for the phone to ring. Right? In fact, I wasn't in the phone book. Didn't bother me. I sat there till I almost went bankrupt. And I would go around to meetings and I'd tell everybody, you know, God sent me down here and then deserted me. You know? The guy took me aside after a meeting one night and he said, "You know, maybe you ought to try doing something to kind of help yourself. You know, God might make potatoes grow, but he doesn't plow the fields and hoe the weeds and harvest the crop. You know, if you want to participate in the bounty, you got to go out there and do some of the work. And God may well have a path for you to follow, but he can't direct you if you're standing on both feet." You know? So I went out and started doing some of the things I was supposed to be doing, and sure enough, things got better. You know? But I was getting screwy at that time. You know, I was running around down here, and well, then I went into the perfect sponsor phase, because I needed a new sponsor now, but I couldn't have just any sponsor. You know, it had to be one that had a better program than I had, you know. And so I would interview them. But I couldn't tell them I was interviewing them because I didn't want to hurt their feelings when they didn't make it, you know. And, of course, I got sicker and sicker. It was just terrible. And finally, I said, "Okay, God, I don't care. Just send me a sponsor, any sponsor. I don't care." And the next four meetings I went to, the subject was sponsorship, and the same guy was at all four meetings. And I said, "Oh, God, not him." He's been my sponsor about 15 years, I guess. And, you know, things were working pretty well. And I got involved in some activities here. I've repeated a lot of these phases. For me today, it's rare for me to have a bad day all day. Because you people have given me the tools, and this great microphone, that I can stop a bad day at any time. I can just say some serenity prayers. I can excuse myself from a meeting and say a lot of serenity prayers. I keep a big book in my desk. I can pick up the phone and call another alcoholic. I can go to a meeting. I can find a new alcoholic to work with. Things get really bad, I can call my sponsor. That ego that I don't have is still a problem on some days, but it's not anywhere near the problem it was 19 years ago. All of my other character defects are still lurking around, and on any given day, one of them can pop up. But none of them are as bad as they were 19 years ago. I am not the same person who walked into these rooms that first night. I am not nearly the person that I could be, but I'm still working on that. And I know now that progress is the key. I no longer have to be perfect. It's okay to make a mistake. No, that's not really true. I hate it. I hate to make mistakes, and I hate to make amends, and I found that if I work this program and do the things I'm supposed to do, I don't screw up nearly as often, so I don't have to make as many amends, and that's a good motivator for me. One of the things, my whole life I've been trained, I've been goal-oriented, and I'm trying to find how to get from point A to point B in the quickest, most efficient manner so that I could get the prize at point B. And as a result of that, I missed all of life between A and B. So now, you know, I don't always do this, but now I try more and more, and I am getting better at enjoying the journey. I'm going along the path, meeting new people, getting around to different meetings, starting to find the joy in this life. All of the promises in the big book have been fulfilled in my life. I've just had, you know, just the wonderful opportunities to work in service and to participate in this program. I'll give you here one more phase. This phase, I've been in this phase so long, it's no longer a phase, it's a way of life. There was a period in my sobriety when I was doing all the things that I was supposed to do. I was going to meetings, I was sponsoring people, I had a sponsor, and I was using that sponsor. I had a home group. I was participating in the responsibilities of that group, and I was miserable. I was miserable. And I'm kind of vocal, as a lot of you know. And I went to my sponsor, and I let him know that, you know, I was doing all these things I was supposed to do, and, you know, time for a little payback. You know, when do things get better? And he said, "Your problem is your attitude. And your attitude is a direct reflection of your gratitude." And I assured him that I was the most grateful alcoholic he'd ever worked with. And he said, "Fine, tell you what you do. You get yourself a little notebook and you carry it with you for the next week. And everything you think of that you're grateful of, you write in that book. And at the end of the week, we'll sit down and we'll go over it." So I got myself a notebook and I went around that week. And it was time to go to the meeting, I went to the meeting, and he said, "Let me see the notebook." And I said, "Well, I was kind of busy this week. I thought I'd just tell you all the things I'm grateful for." He said, no, you don't understand. Carry it around again this week. This week, write down everything you're grateful for." So I went running around for another week, and it was time to go to the meeting, and the paper was blank, you know, so I sat down and I wrote all the standards. You know, "I'm grateful to be alive. I'm grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful I'm sober." And after the meeting, we sat down, I showed him the notebook, he tore the page out, ripped it up, and said, "No, you still don't understand. Carry it around again this week, and this time find one thing for which you're grateful." So now I started to worry. I started into the next week, and I couldn't think of anything. And one of the things that I've done right from the very start, I get up a little early in the morning, and I have a quiet time, and I talk to my higher power. And over the years, I've developed a relationship with my higher power. And I just talk to him like I talk to anybody in this room. And I just start off every day saying, "My name's Dick. I'm an alcoholic. Keep me from the first drink today." And then I talk with him and ask for guidance and what his will might be. And I talked to him. I said, "You know, you got to help me out here. I have a problem. I got 4 more days to find something to be grateful for." You know? And it came to me. I was grateful for indoor plumbing. Think about it, it was cold outside, you know. And from indoor plumbing, I became grateful for hot water. And from hot water, I became grateful for toothpaste. And the more things I thought about to become grateful for, the more grateful I became, the more grateful I became, the more things I thought of to be grateful for. And I became grateful for the little flowers that bloom, the birds that sing. And nothing in my life had changed. Everything in my life was better. So now when I get up in the morning and I'm such a hot shot and I don't have time to make a gratitude list, and I dash through my meditation and I run out the front door and I have a flat tire, day is shot. Okay? I'm kicking the car, I'm cussing, I'm swearing, I'm blaming Carolyn. But if instead I take a few minutes and I remember to be grateful for hot water and the little birds who sing, then when I go running out the front door and I have a flat tire, I say, "Thank God I have a spare. Thank you for helping me stay sober."